ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC AFL Daily for your Tuesday. Corbin Middlemass alongside the Footscray heartthrob Bob Murphy. Bob, happy Tuesday.
Well, it's going to be a special day and a special episode, just in case.
Tell us why.
Anyone doesn't know, that is the first time all season that Corbin's intro has come off the middle of the bat and we haven't had to do it again. I'm not sure what to do now.
So Zach Crawley, first ball of the Ashes, 0-4. It's every other week we've had a false start and redone it, but here we're straight into it.
Wow.
Straight into it.
Gather my thoughts now.
You can tell I got to go to the airport.
Okay. See, always back self-interest.
Correct. Straight out. No time for a redo on that front. A whole lot to chop up. The Geelong story's obviously been a hot button issue all weekend after Jay Clark's reporting on Thursday that, originally that a Cats player was involved in a secret deal with a waiver signed between he and the club. We later learnt that the club was Geelong and that the player was Jake Colajasny. Just general, sort of in a nutshell, overview, tough thing to try and sum up in a couple of sentences, but what's been your view on this entire story?
Stinks to high heaven. That's been the feel, and you know that's not a revolutionary opinion. It just felt like right from the start, when you heard as soon as there was another page, another document outside of the contract, it was like, okay, well, that doesn't pass the test. And then all of the talk around it and the casual language around it from serious people in serious positions of leadership, it didn't cut it for anyone, I don't think, and it picked up steam really, really quickly. And one of the things that has annoyed me about the last 24 hours is as we go, there'll be more information and it starts to get a little bit more murky. And the latest report that I was across, you might be across more than I am, Corbin, was, there was communication between Geelong and the AFL, and there was some paper trail, and there was communication, but then it just wasn't lodged. And I wanted to say, stop, pause. Now it's getting murky and the water's getting foggy. It's like, it should have been in the contract. Geelong experienced administrators. You knew it had to go in the contract. It wasn't in the contract. I've signed a bunch of these things. I know how serious and I know how thorough they are. It's like, yes, it is complex and it is nuanced and it is all of these things. And you know what else it is? Really simple.
Simple. I was going to say, this bit is simple. This is if you just look solely at the waiver, or I know we've got a new name for it, the voluntary assumption of risk, which is the latest terminology for it, which, you know, all your lawyer friends will tell you that is important as to the differentiation between the two. But essentially, yeah, to read the fine print here, you take upon yourself the physical and legal risk of loss, damage or injury of any kind arising directly or indirectly as a result of concussion sustained by you following your decision. So you can call it a waiver, you can call it that. Essentially, we're talking about the same thing. That part is not allowed to be in there, and that's pretty open and shut on that front. Jared Whateley was at his best last night on AFL 360. There was a whole lot to pull apart from various different angles on Fox Footy. And in particular, the one that's caught a lot of attention is that the focus on the chairman of the AFL, and this is the figurehead of the sport. This is what he had to say about Craig Drummond last night.
At the end, you're going to have to justify one way or the other. Can a chairman who runs on a platform of governance, who presided over a failure so significant of governance of this, remain at the head of the organisation? Is he a diminished figure? What is Craig Drummond's capacity to sit in judgment of other clubs in the next period of time?
Yep.
It's zero.
Yep.
If you don't submit yourself to the full investigation, public faith is lost, industry faith is lost. If you run it all the way through and go, these are the facts, and this is why these people are able to continue, that has a chance. But a Thursday fine of $75,000, $100,000 to end the episode with the failure to lodge, that is not enough.
And to make it go away, let's not muck around here. And to make it go away so he can then have the footy world turn its attention to whether Josh Fraser is going to coach and who Essendon coach is and the wild card. That's their great hope. And you're saying it's not enough, and I tend to agree with you. So what is the chances that this will go down the path?
At the moment, that's not the direction it's heading. I think it should. I think those in charge, those who sit on the commission, should realise there is a public faith here that is at stake.
Yeah.
And there is the chairman of the commission who's going to stand there on Brownlow night and stand there at the Hall of Fame. That person can't be a diminished figure in the eyes of the football community. No.
That view was also expressed by Sonia Hood, who's an AFL club president, obviously, that the president at North Melbourne, speaking to Raf Epstein on 774 yesterday, saying, "I think it needs an independent assessment. I don't think anyone would argue with that." As Jared said there, it doesn't feel like it's going down that path. How important is it for the game that this isn't just, hey, here's the fine for Geelong and this issue's done
with? Well, is it a punishment, or is it going to be something just to appease? That would be my view, and I think that's what a lot of people's eyeballs are looking at, and that's what the senses are tuned into. It's like, what's really going on here? I feel like it's such a critical moment. I mean, this is outside of the wins and losses and who's coaching and the latter. Concussion and brain health is the biggest story in the game, I believe.
Yeah.
And if the chairman of the AFL had his fingerprints all over this, I feel like the levels of mistrust at the moment aren't great anyway. We just had the Four Corners documentary where it seeps in like bore water.
Yeah.
That's how it feels. And we have spuds round and we have all of these things that look over here whilst we allow these things and we make these maneuvers and judgments, and not by bit part players, by the leaders of the game. Yeah. And then not insignificant.
And you got a big orange stain on your fence from the ball water. And it's no
not
good
what you
all.
Want. See, not I at walked all. Into that
yes.
WA boy. Here am I talking about ball water. I'm talking to Corbin Middlemass. Public apology.
Geelong did call it an emergency board meeting yesterday. They've got essentially until today. Later today, they'll release their response basically to the AFL's Please Explain. That emergency board meeting included Andrew McDonald, who's the coach of the Australian cricket team, so they're preparing to play that test match up in Darwin. Had to jump on the Zoom call and be part of that and hook up with the rest of the Cats. What you're talking about, the mistrust, I think even if you extrapolate it out further, and I don't want to go too zoomed out, but look at what's happening in society more broadly. Like, there is a level of mistrust in big organisations and authority figures and everything else at the moment.
And we talked about the simplicity of it. And yes, there is complexity and nuance around it. And I totally understand the detail around it's not just sending players to the wolves and that there's no concern for health. I understand that. But there's, at best, a high level of naivety and at worst, significant deceit.
Yep.
So it needs to be dealt with.
What do we always say about the cover-up worse than the crime? There's part of that here as well, that they didn't cop to it originally. And I think the AFL, of their media team in the past, have been very used to, we'll just drag out the trash.
It felt like
6 o'clock press conference before a game.
The strategy felt like...
Terrible.
Felt like old technology for a new war.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The human at the centre of this, and we don't want to sort of overstate that, and it was expressed beautifully by Nathan Buckley on the couch last night, obviously, a current assistant coach with the Cats. That's what he had to say about Jake Colajasny.
Yeah, I spoke to him briefly on Friday, and that was everything was still sort of coming to pass at that point, and it's fair to say he was pretty rattled at the time. He was going along his business, as you talk about, Lee, having chosen his path forward and wanting to play the game and understanding the risks that I suppose the circumstance that he was in. But, with the advent of this revelation, his circumstances have changed, quite significantly. Didn't see him at the club today, but the club is putting a lot of support around him, as you would suspect. He's in a holding pattern, waiting to see what happens to his career beyond here.
Really, I mean, a lot of the attention, he's the case study at the centre of it, but it's mainly on the club and how they handle it. But in the short term, his career is on hold.
Yeah, I mean, it is. That's which is not insignificant in itself. And wish him, wish Jake Colajasny all the best. But that's not sort of where my attention is sort of at this point.
Essendon, what it means for them in their coaching search. So the Bombers seemingly going to hit pause on their process, at least for another week. This is what John Rolfe had to say on the couch last night.
So Essendon has told its four coaching applicants it's going to need another week to work through this process. Now, it might end up whittling those four candidates from four down to two, and certainly one of them might end up meeting the board. Now, of course, this isn't a week where Mark McVay, the Sydney assistant coach, coaches against Essendon on Sunday night. The spectre of James Hurd certainly looms large. Now, I can tell you that he has personally contacted the likes of Toby Green and Lachie Neale to pitch his wares as he makes plans, if it is that he is appointed as the Essendon coach, well, for a third time. He believes that Essendon can bounce hard with a blend of experience that he would bring in unrestricted free agents, and certainly the young kids that he would develop. That is his priority, developing those young kids, even if he has to spend across the AFL's soft cap. He's told Green he would be the first man that he would call if he was appointed. Now, he believes he's got that perfect blend of hardness and leadership, and believes by the end of his career, he should be playing 30 big blockbusters at the MCG, Anzac Day, Dreamtime at the G, and potentially finals, because he believes this club can win finals in the 3 or 4 years that Toby would be there. Toby, of course, is less likely to come, more likely to get to a Geelong or stay at GWS. And of course, Lachie Neale is less likely as well. Mark McVay and James Hurd both told interim coach Dean Solomon if it was that he was appointed, they wouldn't be his assistant. James wants to be the front man. And of course, Mark has family in Sydney. But he and McVay have spoken about whether they could work together as a dream team. We're not sure where that's at if one of them is appointed. But certainly Essendon is aware of the weight of this James Hurd decision. Now, they ignore Hurd. The next coach is on a hiding to nothing. They appoint him and it doesn't go well. Of course, we know the ramifications there. They are very risky.
Come with me here, Bob. So, interview process.
I need a bit of help here.
Okay.
I need a bit of help here. I'm entertained by it all. Don't get me wrong. There's not a hint of boredom, but this is keeps getting into deeper and deeper and more colourful waters.
So, Mitch Cleary on 7 News last night reported that James Hurd and Murray Davis both met with the Bombers on Thursday. Mark McVay met with them on Saturday, and on Friday, and Jamie Graham met with them on Saturday. So, essentially, across 3 days, they met with the four candidates. The subcommittee still needs time to meet to debrief the presentations. Now, maybe it's a bit more complex than I think, but surely once you've heard the last guy present, everybody in that room's got a pretty good idea who the winner is, don't they?
So as soon as I heard that there was a delay,
yeah,
then I go into an intense game of solo poker. Yeah. You know, it's just like, what? Why?
There's only one reason, isn't there?
So please, enlighten me. Is it just the machinations of how it's James?
Or is it the fact that Essendon play Sydney this week and they don't want to appoint Mark McVay, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're coming up against the Swans and you got the guy who's coaching your team in the opposition coach's box and it's just an awkward look?
Wouldn't that be good for Essendon?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be? I mean,
I just don't understand why it would take all week then.
I'm not too sure either.
And I don't know anything, by the way. So it could turn out it's not Mark McVay and someone else comes along and ends up coaching the team. And
the tactic of bringing in hypotheticals, I mean, if I was Jamie Graham, I'd say, look, I just spoke to Buddy Franklin, just off the phone to Tony Lockett, also David Dench. He's keen to get involved.
Are you starting to think there's more likely to be James Hurd now that he's still standing in with this deep in?
This week, from last week to this week,
yep,
I'm feeling more inclined to think that the McVay Hurd thing has a bit more. But I have to confess to you. Forgive me, Father.
I get the sense there was a push somewhere behind the scenes to have this sort of Essendon supergroup with all three of them involved. I'd be very surprised if any one of them works with any other one of them. So I think the only way Mark McVay is coming, and yeah, he's got young family that's based in and around Sydney, he's coming to be the senior coach. Same way James Hurd's coming to coach the team, and Dean Solomon, you know, was planning to do that and obviously, you know, ended up not running in the process. But yeah, I'd be shocked if somehow there's a combination of them that work together.
Yeah.
But we'll see. They're saying now not until next week, which feels like a long time to debrief some presentations.
Well, that's, you know, Murray Davis has to get on the phone to Dick Reynolds and Hayden Bunton, Gordon Coventry.
See who we can bring back.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. The Carlton, if you're Jamie Graham now, basically you're chips in with Essendon, aren't you? Like you're saying, if he wasn't already thinking, well, hey, I'm sniffing the breeze here, that Fraser's going to get that gig.
See, now we're in waters that I am a bit more familiar with.
Mm.
So, Jamie Graham, as I understood it, had impressed beyond expectations within Carlton that he'd He really performed well. He was, if not the favourite, was right up there. And Josh Fraser has gone on to do what he has with the team and hasn't put a foot wrong. And has just, you know, has played it like classical music.
Yeah.
And then a layer deeper to that is that in terms stylistically, Jamie and Josh are similar. I would argue that Jamie is still even more experienced and ready to go, but they are a similar style. The same sort of temperament, same, you know, I wouldn't imagine philosophically they'd be too misaligned. So I would think that Carlton will say, well, we've got this guy and we know what's happening out on the field and everyone, you know, everyone's in harmony. So it's unfortunate, but
yeah,
you go with Josh Fraser. It's a certainty, isn't it?
Essendon, I think so. I think that this is only the second 12-week run where they've won 10 games, so gone 10-2 in a 12-week stretch since 2000. So they had one under Michael Voss in 2023, then this is it. So there's 30-year-old Carlton fans walking around saying this is the second best occasion it's ever been in my lifetime, watching a team over a three-month period. So it's pretty hard to turn that guy down.
Who would be a better documentary this year, Carlton or Essendon? It'd be a good two-parter, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it?
Who's your pick?
Probably the Bombers. Yeah.
Okay.
What do you think? You reckon? The Fraser story's...
No, I'm probably the Bombers.
Yeah.
I would, again, I've said it before, I just wish that this coaching process had been filmed in its entirety.
Yeah. Like, if you think about...
Warts and all, fly on the wall.
So if I said to you, any other team in the competition, sacks their coach tomorrow and they're on the search for, you know, their next senior coach, you would think Jamie Graham would be amongst the favourites. He's down to four in the Essendon process, and I think there's probably, you put your finger in the wind, people will be a little bit surprised if he gets it.
Mm.
How is that the case?
Yeah.
Like he's as credentialed as anyone, and yet it sort of feels like, oh, it'll probably be one of the Essendon boys, but yeah, maybe it might be Jamie Graham, and then people probably feel, you know, to a lesser extent, Murray Davis, even though, again, excellent coaching resume.
I know we stay in the moment, namaste, but at the next coaching search, you know, next year or the year after, we have to be on it when they say, oh, yeah, well, Enright and Jamie Graham and James Kelly, oh, they missed it. It's like, hang on, no. The tropical environment that all happened is not going to be relevant ever again, I wouldn't have thought.
In the end, they're really not even going to be able to run a proper process, are they? Because they've just got an undeniable option in front of them.
It could be, the course of public opinion, rather.
Yep. St Kilda. So they had a loss on Sunday night, and they lost Nasai Wanganeen-Miller in the opening moment. So he's done a hamstring. His season's over, regardless on how long St Kilda hang in the season, you'd think. Understandably, it was a topic of conversation last night on the Agenda Setters on Channel 7.
If they serve up another 11th on the ladder next year, does Naz stay? They're into this again next year. He's out for the rest of this year. We just saw the vision.
Yep.
They risked him on the weekend. Fair enough. It didn't work.
Well, I remember Ross saying we've got 2 years to sort of prove it to him.
The halftime score doesn't reflect well on that.
No, it doesn't. So you're behind at halftime.
Behind at halftime. Nick Riewoldt on the Nasai Wanganeen-Miller prove it 2-year contract. Agree with that?
I'm not out on St Kilda jumping next year.
Okay.
I just philosophically have the view that when you bring in as many new players as St Kilda has, that it does take 12 to 18 months for it to gel. And watching them this year, you know, there's been mixed results. They've been up and down. But the back half of the year, I've seen it start to gel. And I've seen them live, I think, 3 times with ABC Sport.
Yep.
And I can see the progression, and I've been impressed. And I feel like them not playing finals this year, I'm not as edgy about it. The pressure is on next year. Like it has to click, but I have a hunch that it might.
Right. Okay. Bit of optimism. I feel like there's two clubs that are going to live sort of last year, next year, if you know what I mean. The 2025 storyline in 2027. One is the Saints with Wanganeen-Miller, and the other one's your club with Luke Beveridge, where it felt like last year he was, you know, in the hot seat. He was coaching for his job. They got the response, at least in the first two-thirds of the season. He got the new contract. Feels like they're going to live the same thing again next year, aren't they, the Dogs?
It does feel like that. It was almost like a bit of a pause on whatever that ecosystem was coming into the year, and then losing Sam Darcy and, you know, being up and down with various things. So we'll see if the Dogs can rattle on, we'll see. But at the moment, you think they wouldn't play a major part in the next couple of months. But He does. He can produce the unexpected, Luke. But next year, it does feel like with the big fella back there at full forward, it will be chips in and playing for the now.
Just jumping back to the Saints, they're high-profile recruits. When you go out on a big spending spree, understandably, that comes with plenty of attention. And when you're in the position they're in, which is on the outside looking in with 2 weeks to go, and by the way, if it was still a top-eight system, they would already be mathematically ruled out of the final series. Comes with a bit of criticism too. This is Footy Classified and Matthew Lloyd last night.
But we always say, how good are these players? How good are these blokes that they've recruited? And I think that we've shown that they're not none of them are really game breakers. None of them are game changers, and they've still got a long way to go. One of these men is Tom De Koning, and I think that he's under as much pressure as Ross Lyon going into next year, just because I think he doesn't compete hard enough. He doesn't have a competitive nature that you'd want for someone. He's just not consistent enough in that area, and his game sense still doesn't look like, for someone who's been in the game for 9 years, someone who understands, still looks very raw, like an athlete at times trying to play the game of AFL football. So he needs a big, big pre-season to try and reach the potential that they hope for him.
Like an athlete trying to play the game of AFL football.
That seemed heavy-handed to me. Yeah, that seemed heavy-handed that Tom De Koning, he's not a superstar. And the contract and the profile, for me, it doesn't match the output. But I think his competitiveness is there.
Does it come with the territory, though, if you take the money?
Oh, I think he's underperformed for the contract. Mm. But I also, I still think that criticism is pretty heavy-handed. It's like he's a project player and he's a bit soft. Mm. I don't think Tom De Koning's a bit soft. I think Rowan Marshall's a better player.
Yeah. Here's one for you, the psychology of it all, and this is the sports guy on the radio. I mean, you're the guy that's been in the locker room and knows how it all works. We keep talking about the fact that it hurts Marshall, the fact that De Koning's come in, they got to share the duties. Is there part of it that Tom De Koning might relish Marshall going? Whereas he sort of walks into this ruck room and the two of them are there trying to share responsibilities. Whereas if Marshall goes, all of a sudden, Tom, this is all on you. You don't have to worry about stepping on anyone's toes. This is, you're the guy. Do your thing.
And this fits into my 18-month theory of you bring in new things, and they're significant new things. Silvani's a key position player. Tom De Koning's a key position player. Liam Ryan plays in a key position of sorts, maybe not the most orthodox one. So those things take a little while to gel. So maybe Tom would benefit from, Rowan's moved on. Max King is at full forward, so we have some ruck relief there. And you are the man. And that might bring out the best in him. But, the lack of competitiveness, I thought, I think that's pretty harsh from Lloydy.
I think that was the reason he didn't play a whole lot with Pitternet towards the back end either. There was, I think I'm keen to see how he goes when he is the guy there. Yeah. I think it'll be good for Rowan. I think it'll be good for Tom next year. Just on recruits. So the story yesterday, Kel Toomey talking about the beefed up offer to Zach Butters, the pitch from Collingwood to make him the highest paid player in the club's history.
You predicted this.
I followed in on Mark Murphy's sort of little lead here. Okay. And my reasoning behind that, which Murph then told me last night that he feels like he didn't have any inside info. But I know Mark Murphy and Lachie Neal are very good friends. And so I thought, I connected the dots. Okay. I'm like, maybe if Murph's talking about Collingwood and Butters, I thought maybe I should follow down that path. I feel like out of any of the clubs in Melbourne, this would be the most interesting landing spot for Butters. I think I have him as the second best player in the competition. He might be the third, fourth, whatever it turns out to be. But if you compare Butters and Nick Daicos together, I know people are saying, it's not basketball. You can't have two superstars and make it work. You might go pretty close. I think if you can get those two guys together and you can put them, even if you put them with a bunch of guys that are on less than average AFL salary, I'm keen to see how it looks. I actually think this is as interesting a landing spot as any team if he goes there.
I feel like, and I don't like the idea of basketball's combination necessarily overtaking our game, but I do feel like inside midfielders is where it carries more weight, which is what you're saying, that the partnership of that inner core of midfielders, there are balances and partnerships that work more than others. And it was all a bit quiet from Collingwood.
Yep.
So we shall wait and see. But it was weeks ago that the sentiment was, he's going to the Bulldogs. So I don't necessarily And feel like that. And I've even got my Bulldogs mug.
I was going to say, you would know better than me, but it feels like talking to people at the Dogs too. They're not confident he's over the line or anything like
that. No, that's not what you sort of hear in the subtext.
So Richmond's, you know, Richmond's the money, potentially the captaincy that comes with it, as soon as, day one. Bunch of young core already in place. The Bulldogs is the sentimental landing spot, which we've touched on. Collingwood, the fame, the big stage, everything that comes with being a Collingwood player. If you want success, you would think Geelong and Hawthorn, two teams that are in and around the window. This has been a problem for teams like Carlton and Essendon in recent times, is it feels like everyone runs away from Broadway. No one wants to come play for the big teams on the big stage, and particularly because they've been such a mess off field. If you want that, you may as well go to Collingwood. It's hard to kind of try and sell Carlton and Essendon. Maybe Carlton a little bit different now, given the run that Fraser's been on. North Melbourne aren't even in the conversation. Melbourne, through Stephen King, said, look, we met with Butter's team earlier in the year. We feel like we're not in the race. So they felt like, it was already too late. And then the other team, which brings us back to where we started, is St Kilda. So I wonder, for all their big spending spree and everything else, maybe they were just a year too early. Like, if you were going to go chips in, get all your pennies together for one guy, wouldn't it be Zach? Like, wouldn't he be the kind of needle mover? And there might only be, 8 to 12 of them in the competition where you go, these guys are proper top flight guys. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else is half a rung below. And then the other point is, which I know people would be screaming at their podcast, wherever they're listening to it at the moment, saying, what about a straight swap? What about if Naz is going to go anyway? You elevate the conversation a year earlier and say, maybe we can get Zach now.
Whiz. Would that be a dramatic bombshell?
We don't get player-for-player swaps anymore. Is this as close to a like-for-like as you could get? Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it's one of the few trades that I'd be able to wrap my intellect around. It'd certainly be a win.
As opposed to a future this and a future that.
Well, the points, we need to take the points into account. Oh, no. Yeah. Not that situation.
What do you reckon the most interesting landing spot would be for him? Any club, seemingly in Victoria?
I think the Collingwood one.
Yeah. The footy on field, Lee Matthews was on the couch last night, and when Lee speaks, we listen.
Did you get the feeling? I reckon that's the first time this year I thought Melbourne are contenders. Yep. I'd never thought that before Saturday.
Win the flag?
But they're contenders. I mean, anything could happen. Mm. But they look like they're contenders. I never thought that up until Saturday. And I reckon Fremantle will be better for the experience too of a high-scoring. They played well. They got beaten, but they still played well, scored big. That'll be good for them when they have to.
Where does it leave Stephen King in terms of your... Like, everyone looks at coaches of the year, and obviously he's a first-year coach, and there's been some good coaching performances this year. Is he the front runner?
There's only one coach of the year. That's the Jock McHale medal winner because he's the premiership coach. Mm. But that aside, if you go to the judgment call of the most improved team, Stephen King and Melbourne would come into that category.
Are they a contender?
Oh, I was just reminiscing that for about 24 hours I had a Jock McHale medal. Yes, nice little shout out from you, Lee. Appreciate the nod.
Former Jock McHale medalist.
Sorry, what was the question? I got distracted there.
The D's. Are they a contender? Can they win the whole thing?
Not that I just want to piggyback onto Lethal, but I had a similar sentiment where I thought, wow, they play exciting footy. They adjust on the fly. Stephen King, if he's not the coach of the year, he's the runner-up.
Yeah.
Love watching them play. Love everything they've done this year. They've almost haven't put a foot wrong in difficult circumstances. And then watching them against Fremantle, I was like, oh right, okay, you're this caliber of team. Gee, we'd be spoilt if it was a Fremantle Melbourne grand final. Ooh. They both,
that was a game.
They don't just play offensive footy; they both play to win.
Mm-hmm.
They defend to win and they attack to win, and they're great, entertaining teams to watch.
I loved it. I was lucky enough to call it. Six lead changes. I think twice Fremantle had it out by 18 points, and you felt like they're about to break the back of this game. Both times Melbourne hung around.
That's what they do, Melbourne.
Yeah.
And Fremantle as well. They didn't lose any admirers, I don't think.
Yeah.
Fremantle.
So that was the interesting. I was going to get to that point. Adam Ramanauskas has been big on the Dockers all year and sort of saw them coming a long way out. He was a bit shaken on the weekend.
Was he?
He felt like, lost contested ball by 25 and, out-tackled. He felt like, it sort of exposed almost a little bit of weakness in Fremantle around the footy. And I know they've been really good at it as the season's gone on, but it also raises another question coming out, which I think is a fun narrative, at least for the season, where if Fremantle had a one on the weekend, we would have been thinking, we've got a dominant team in the competition. The question is, can they get it done in the finals? But now it's almost like they are a dominant team. They're undefeated at home. But then they got to come back to the MCG and answer that question. And they're only going to get one opportunity for that, and it's on grand final day. That's the next time they get the chance to play at the MCG, seemingly, if all things go well in the finals. Justin Longmuir was on AFL 360 last night and was put that question.
The MCG, you have had big wins there and you didn't lose because of the ground. Was it irritating to lose that game and that becomes a narrative on your way through to hopefully the biggest day?
Yeah, I guess if you put it in that sense, it is, because I don't think the ground had much to do with it. And like you said, we've had some really good wins there. And you know, last year we went and beat Collingwood, who were on top of the ladder at the time. So we feel like we've played the game, the ground well. But it was a good hit out for us. Melbourne have only lost one game there this year. You know, their crowd got up and about and behind us. We haven't been in those tight game situations for a while, so we'll learn a lot out of that last 10 minutes.
Is there a little vulnerability there in the Dockers?
I mean, they're beatable. They're absolutely beatable. But no, I think they would have... I think it. You could make an argument that it was a win for them as well.
Mm.
To go the distance at the MCG in daylight against a side that was hungry, I think it lifted their game. I don't think they've got too many...
Even though they didn't win?
Yeah, I don't think they've got too many concerns from it.
I think they're a lock to get there, but they haven't lost at home all year. They're going to get all the advantages, obviously finish on top with the home quali and the home prelim. But I think they're a 50-50 shot on grand final day, which is the fascinating. If they draw Brisbane, if they draw Geelong, if they draw Hawthorn on grand final day, you think, well, I'm not so sure about that matchup.
Is that why? Purely because of the grant? Like,
I think that all of that comes situation into it. And then which we've spoken about in the past, they don't have the burden of history like the Dockers do. The Dockers are trying to become the first team ever. Those three clubs that I mentioned have all won premierships recently and won a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would love the Swans. I think the Dockers, give us Sydney. I hope they run that side of the bracket. We'll run this side and then we'll meet together. I think they'd be happy with Adelaide, someone like that. But I worry about those other three teams for them. Keep in mind, too, a lot of people retrospectively, and I heard this put on one of the shows last night, it's more open than previous years. We don't have a dominant team, like Brisbane, for example. And I thought, oh, hang on. Brisbane were the underdog in both of their grand finals. Yeah. So it's amazing how we fit things up retrospectively.
Yeah. Because they won them. So
because they won them. And they end up having this dynasty where, they win, playing three grand finals, win two. But that wasn't a straight line to the finish in either of those years.
No, so they come home with a rush, the Lions.
Yeah. Three cheers for Taylor Walker
Walker, yeah.
Which you did raise a little question yesterday when we were talking about this.
Well, I did. And I wanted to give you options, but his record speaks for itself, and his last 50 games. So what do you end up on? 320, I think. Like a lot of footy, but the last section of his career has been pretty damn good. So, is he the greatest field kick of any key forward we've ever had? So in the conversation we'd have, Buddy,
Big Budwa,
Chris Grant needs an acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
Tex Walker. They're the three that I was thinking of. So genuine key forwards, field kicking. Like just their foot skills, all round foot skills.
Mm.
Can you think of any others? If you were teaching a young footballer how to kick the ball, you could show him a video of Tex.
That's a really good shout out. I remember talking about Buddy a lot in that fashion, didn't we? We always said, hey, it's great he kicks all those goals, but what about what he does around the ground?
Kicking.
He can put it in a bucket.
Don't know if Buddy's right foot was as good as Tex's left. Chris Grant's left was as good as his right.
Now I'm just thinking more about those big mobile guys that sort of like the Matthew Pavliches of the world. That
Pav.
Yeah.
Pretty, but I think I'm not sure if he was
that level. Oh, I agree.
And the other thing was the level of dedication and
Loyalty
and stoicism for the moustache.
Yep.
So Jake Lever has, he's hopped on board, but I feel like Tex, the modern sort of torchbearer for the moustache.
Favourite moustaches throughout history?
Do you know where my mind went to? So you just have to go, you've got to be honest, Bernard Tui.
Right.
I couldn't shake it. I know there's been others. I know there's been a lot of strong tash work out there, but I went to Bernard Tuohy. Shout out to Bernard Tuohy. Have you got one?
I do. That mine's very obscure.
So, well, excellent.
Fremantle and St Kilda fans will know who I'm talking about. A guy named Gavin Mitchell.
Gavin Mitchell.
Gavin Mitchell, who actually tackled Peter Carey when he took the mark. So he was the first one on the scene, essentially, when that famous Fremantle-St Kilda game at Subiaco Oval. But Gavin Mitchell, he played for Claremont in the WAFL too, which was my club.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he always had a little quivery moustache, had it his whole career. Was
his more of like a little sort of anchovy more than the...
It's a little big, caterpillar sort of
look. Yeah, a little caterpillar one.
But
we appreciate all different types.
I was a big Gavin Mitchell fan. He was did some really nice things.
Well, I liked Bernard Tuohy as well.
There we go. This might be a good little socials fodder. So what do they say on the socials video? Just can put your best moustaches in the comments.
Leave the best moustache down below.
You don't have to wait long this week on ABC AFL Daily because coming up tomorrow we'll have a full round preview. The reason for that is Ben and I are off to do the cricket. So around our schedules, we've moved the day.
Just don't lose focus, okay?
We won't.
I'll be keeping an eye on you around your footy stuff.
We'll chop it all up again next week. So we'll see what's going on in the footy landscape. That's just about us done on ABC AFL Daily. There's one big game coming up on Sunday. Essentially, the Blues win. The top 10 is decided. It's just about positioning going into the final round of the home and away season. Do the Blues get it done against your Dogs?
No.
Ooh. Okay.
With hope.
It breeds a bit of life into the final round if that's the case. All right, we're out of here. Home of your footy conversation, ABC AFL Daily with five drops a week.